Vietnamese women are considered very strong, very much a pillar in the family, but not always to the benefit of the women. It's sort of a motherland, mother role.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Hua Nguyen, whose collection of poetry, A Thousand Times You Lose Your Treasure, is a multi-layered, narrative, divinatory, and biographical text that centers Vietnam and Hua's mother, Diep An Nguyen, a stunt motorcyclist in an all-woman Vietnamese circus troupe. Born in Vinh Long in the year of the fire horse, Hua was raised and educated in the U.S. and has lived in Canada since 2011. Hua, welcome to The Right Question.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What has your last year been like? How have you maneuvered through Canada's shutdown, through the pandemic? How are you?
Oh, thanks so much for asking. It's been a year. We're recording this actually just a couple of days after a terrible set of murders in Atlanta, Georgia. So I'm feeling particularly heavy right now, thinking about the rise of anti-Asian hate and how loud it is right now. And it makes this time even more difficult. I'm finding some solace in the company of the artists and friends and activists that I have. And it's really great to be here with you.
I'm so glad to have you here. What has your experience been in Canada navigating these recent events? Do you feel like they are similar to what's happening here, or do you feel like it's different?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask. You're asking someone who feels the events personally and this recent uptick in violence against Asians. In particular, the targeting of elders has been really painful. And it's not just in the U.S., it's in Canada too. There's been more airing of the news because of the news that's come out of the targeting of the Asian women in Atlanta. And that's an interesting thing to see spoken about publicly here and in the U.S. I think it's something that Asian Americans have dealt with for a long time, which is the sensation of being the perpetual foreigner, unwanted, held up as model minority, but mostly to have a kind of wedge against blackness, to play blackness and brown and Asianness against each other for a lower position of status and opportunity. And also as a woman, the fetishization and the dehumanization that is a part of like the regular experience, it just brings all that up. So anyway, that's how I'm doing today. I mean, it's relevant too to my writing my book in that I was interested in how stories can be told from different perspectives. And in this case, a very specifically Vietnamese diasporic perspective, an immigrant perspective, a woman's perspective, or many women's perspective, a non-Western perspective, you could say. Although it's in English and it's also from me, a Westerner, but it's not the narratives you get to see typically about women from Vietnam, women of my mother's generation. I would also say women in general of my mother's generation, the ways in which patriarchy has shaped her life experiences and potentials for life, the multiple intersections of oppression. Anyway, this is all very depressing to speak of, but the book isn't, I don't think, depressing. In fact, I think there's a way in which it tries to engage with these subjects in a kind of state of subversion, which includes jokes and retellings of ghost stories, some cultural information, and elevating the archive pieces into new ways of knowing.
What do you want readers to feel when they read this book?
That's a really interesting question. What do I want people to feel, readers to feel? I think a sensation of a life lived unapologetically would be one thing I hope that they would take from the book, that Asian American experiences aren't monolithic, that they're actually quite varied and complex. They have backstory and there are names. There are journeys and complications along the way. There's loss and there's reveling. I guess I would hope for ways in which people can examine patterns of narration that could make room for new possibilities in a kind of mythic space. I've always been interested in stories that can describe or illustrate something that's difficult to understand. And I think poetry, like myth, can create those kinds of spaces where you can have multiple levels, allow for multiple and complex perspectives so that something deep and complex can be understood when the story gets told.
Divination is another kind of method to this understanding, right? You use both the tarot and the I Ching, this book of changes. They both appear in your book, and at least to my eye, my unknowing eye or my somewhat knowing eye, most explicitly as the Tower card and as Hexagram 51, respectively. Can you explain to listeners how these divination practices operate in the book and maybe more broadly in your poetry? And then specifically how the Tower and Hexagram 51 become sort of intertwined in the narrative that you're tracing in the book?
Thank you for asking about that. Right. So Hexagram 51 is the hexagram that I received when I consulted the Book of Changes, the I Ching, when I first started to write specifically towards this book. I had wanted to write this book for a long time, which is partly, like I said, a kind of lyric narration of a diasporic Vietnamese experience. It's also part biography and verse of my mother's very colorful life, telling stories around the time in which she served as a motorcyclist in a circus, in a Vietnamese circus. She was part of an all-woman motorcycle troupe and did these incredible feats of daring, riding her motorbike inside of a structure they called the barrel. And these are all stories that I grew up with, and yet they couldn't be released in any sort of meaningful way. They weren't legible to anyone. I remember very specifically in elementary school telling another elementary school kid that my mother had been in a circus and rode motorcycles, and they thought I was lying. They couldn't believe me. They had nowhere to put that information in a way that made sense to them, because every story that they would see that actually women that look like my mother or from country like my mother's are basically extras in a movie that basically say like a scream and then die. So it's a route in these tools that I use, the I Ching being one of the first sort of books that I consulted that had specific Asian philosophy as part of it. It's like, what is it, 10,000 years old? It's one of the oldest books, right? And you consult it by using chance operations. In my case, I was using the coin system where you take three coins and you toss them in the pattern that emerges from the heads and tails pattern allows you to arrive at the shape of the hexagram. You know how to draw it from that. It's not that hard. It sounds a bit complex, but you basically toss three coins six times, and following a set of patterns, it will lead you to draw these set of broken and solid lines that they call a hexagram, six lines, thus hex. And then you go to the book and you read the corresponding fortune that they call it, or what the sage has to say. So the corresponding text then for the time that I consulted the I Ching produced hexagram 51, which is shock, thunder. And the image that came from the fortune included the line, 100,000 times you lose your treasure. It's basically a fortune of great loss and convulsive change and sudden, you know, struck by lightning. It's a startling fortune to receive, and I was just sort of organizing myself to kind of gear up to write this, and I didn't know quite where to put this information. So the next day, I sat down and I threw my coins again, and I arrived at the same hexagram. Now, the odds of any hexagram are quite large to be able to get them two times in a row, but I actually threw the coins, I think, four times, and I drew the same hexagram. So I understood that I had to pay attention to the themes of convulsivity, which makes sense because I was writing about an incredibly convulsive time in the country of Vietnam where my mother lived. She was from Canta, which is in the Delta, but she spent her adult life in Vinh Long, about 20 minutes from Saigon.
So you've known about this history since you were small. What made you finally say, I'm ready to write these poems? I'm ready to tell this story, to tell the story of my mother's history, but also to tell the story of your heritage, of your understanding of your past, your history, your family?
I think that I needed perspective. I also needed the space to see my own place in history. I think I actually had been trying to write the poems that are finally in this book across my books. I can see glimpses of it in certain poems. I think I was prepared by the fact of my mother being older and being more willing to talk about Vietnam. I wouldn't say that I learned a lot from my trip to Vietnam, but in preparing to go, and I think really what allowed me passage emotionally were friendships that began 5 years ago by virtue of the Diasporic Vietnamese Artists Network, which is an organization that whose mission is to elevate Vietnamese diasporic perspectives in literature. It was started by Viet Nguyen, whose first novel won a Pulitzer a few years ago, with Isabelle Peloud, who, like myself, is mixed race. And it was through their organization and an offshoot of their organization called She Who Has No Masters, which is a group of diasporic Vietnamese women and women-identifying writers and non-binary writers. And we were able to go on a residency together. And it was actually being with those women and sharing our stories that I think gave me my first breakthrough towards this. It's really about, I think, a kind of deepening of my relationships, my relationship with my mother, my relationship with other writers, relationship with myself, my relationship with history.
Was it a novel thing that a group of women were these motorcyclists? Do you know kind of how that played out in 1958?
Well, it was utterly unusual. I mean, it's still utterly unusual. It's a pretty conservative place, and the 50s were a conservative place, lots of places. Certainly that was the case in Vietnam. My mother was just a very defiant, wayward, intentionally wayward person. I think she saw the limitations of patriarchy. She knew as a poor farm girl, she wouldn't be offered any opportunities for education. She wasn't. And what she would be offered would be to be married off and to have a household and children. And that's not what she wanted for herself. She wanted to learn how to read. And so she made a friend who taught her how to read while they were supposed to be doing like chores. And then she left home when she was 15. No, it was completely unusual. And at the same time, Vietnamese women are considered very strong, very much a kind of pillar in the family and in communities, but not always to the benefit of the women. It's sort of a motherland, mother role, which is sort of part of the package that my mother refused. So she decided to do it her own way. There was a number of synchronicities that led her to find herself trying out for the all-woman motorcycle troop. But the troop itself started in 1956, and she was among the first to be part of Viet Hung, which is the name of her troop.
Maybe you can read a poem that kind of speaks to that tryout, Tryouts for the Flying Motorist Artist Team, 1958. I would love to hear that.
Sure. This is a poem from the book. She had worked for the circus as sort of a Girl Friday, like washing clothes and getting the groceries and whatnot, because she was too young. So she finally got to try out for the team. And this is the story in poem form. Tryouts for the Flying Motorist Artist Team, 1958. She tried sliding, pedaled, torn pants. Tryouts, a test of strength in the barrel. Ride a bicycle. Are you sure? A bicycle? A bicycle. Push and pedal, climb high banked sides, to try again and fall, to try again and fall, running blood. They said, okay, stop, enough, you're in. She said, I was the darkest one and the prettiest. To save performance shoes, they trained barefoot. She took a taste of earth. Held hands on the wall of death.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Hua Wen, author of A Thousand Times You Lose Your Treasure. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. There are a number of poems that elicit ghosts or speak to hauntings in this book. Can a text be haunted?
Sure. I mean, I think language itself is haunted. You know, there's all these echoes languages and resonances and connotations when they come into use. Etymology is of deep interest to me in looking at those traces. I do like to think of the book as a kind of resonating with the tracings, actually. So yes, language itself is one of the ways that I think of a text being haunted. I mean, I think that sound itself can be quite haunting, right? Like you can think of phrases that find you, turns of phrases that stay with you, descriptions that create a scene. I mean, if you think of even in poetry, you know, much is said about the image, and what's really meant is the apparition, right? The phantasm that language can activate in the visual field, which is actually figment. It's not present. It's not even in front of your eyes. It's somewhere in your interior. So I think that there's a way in which that relationship to text has always been one of its ability to communicate across time and its ability to create a space where lived lives can actually feel palpable and real.
What was language like in your family day to day?
Well, it was a really hard time to be a Vietnamese when my mother arrived from Vietnam. It was 1968. There weren't a lot of Vietnamese Americans at that time or Vietnamese immigrants at that time. It was very early in the diaspora. And she had married a white American whose Vietnamese was pretty poor. So, you know, she found herself among English speakers without people to speak Vietnamese with, including her husband. It was a very unpopular war. And so, you know, the ways of protection is to assimilate, right? To try to lose your accent and certainly lose your any markings that would further mark you with difference. And then it was also the prevailing, I think, parenting advice at the time, you know, don't raise your children in bilingual households. and certainly don't teach them a useless language like Vietnamese. I think that's actually a really common story. You hear that story of people who were from Italian or German immigrant families during World War II, that you might suppress your home country's language because you're deemed the enemy, even though you're like fighting on the same side. But that's lost on a lot of Americans. I mean, the racism was present. She didn't talk about that a lot either. I asked her about it later. She says it was hard. That's all she would really say about it.
The book's opening poem concludes with the line, "The future's not ours to see tenderly." I immediately thought of Que Sera, Sera, which is explicitly stated in another poem. There's also a line from Oh My Darling, the Clementine song. And when I was reading the notes at the back of the book, so much of your inspiration comes from song recordings or from podcasts, propaganda recordings, all these sonic sources. Where does this audio component fit into the narrative of the book or into the histories you're writing about?
Well, obviously language, like you said, has a sonic component to it. And Vietnamese also is a tonal, so it has even additional sounds that we don't use in English. So there's also a way in which I'm interested in sound as how it might be interpretive. In other words, like, how could I capture saying something in Vietnamese, a language I don't have, in English, is, I think, long been an unspoken mechanism inside of my writing, why I became a poet. When I was a student at my university, I went to a big state university. I was a DJ at the radio station, actually, back in at the height of like 80s, like punk, post-punk, alternate music. And so it was this, I identified with making a kind of righteous noise, doing it yourself, defiance of the mainstream. So music and sound has always been really important to me. And I think it really did begin with losing my language. I think this sort of seeking has always been central. Also, if you look at my chart, it's really there. It's like my fourth house is in Pisces, where Chiron and Saturn are. And it's all about like original wounds. And I went to see a star person. And they were like, oh, yes. Right, you were born in the height of the war, which is a terribly racist, imperialist war. Of course, this shows up in your chart with Saturn and Pisces in your fourth house.
What poetic lineages are you working within in this book? And, you know, that might mean formally or it might mean topically, using images of divination or however you want to read that question.
I definitely drew upon my lineage that comes from my long practice, which is informed by experimental writers in the 20th century who were not coming from necessarily intellectual centers, were starting experimental schools, doing a lot of like hanging out and starting their own magazines. This kind of spirit that's often called like outrider perspectives or positions, they end up being sort of central in the end, like if you think of like a figure like Allen Ginsberg of the Beats. But they began in this sort of positionality of commenting from the position of outside, in Ginsberg's case as a queer man. And I carry with me like their legacies and the traditions that inform me, which also include classical relationships to language. You know, my first love of poetry was Keats. I named my firstborn Keaton in a sidelong homage to John Keats, who I actually have learned a lot from. And I would say specifically for this book, the poet Teresa Hawk Cha, whose book Dictée came out in the 80s. It was an extremely sort of genre-defying novel that centered a sort of matrilineage retelling in a sort of mythic style, very experimental and very interested in its own modes of meaning making. I think Dictée is certainly central to my understanding of what's possible in a retelling. I think I mentioned my diasporic women writers just as a sort of body of spirit was essential. And also is interested in looking at books that have as part of their aims a kind of investigative or documentary purposing. And that's like shared among many poets that I don't dare name because there are many and they're friends that inform and feed my understandings of what's possible. When thinking about the archive, and I mentioned Sadia Hartman earlier, she's certainly someone that has inspired as a nonfiction writer. I think the nonfiction area for sure has been particularly relevant for my thinking towards this book, but also it's really a lyric poem at the same time. And it's also serial in that it's, even though it's composed of individual poems, as a group, my intention is that they orchestrate into some other constellation of meanings together.
Can you read Made by Tao?
Yeah, totally. Made by Tao. The white woman, rather thin with a cinched vintage coat, who I met and later referred to as Pillbox, saying, I call her Pillbox. January, it was night in a warehouse space after an evening of poetry performances, a small, warm setting, very cold winter, think black, red, and white. Table set with antlers and roasted marrow. She, loud laughing earlier at a poem about Vietnamese people, or I thought so, and even asked about the joke, did you get that on the inside, I had said. But she, being Pillbox, said nothing and later shared a Bic lighter by tossing it at me or toward me. But no, not simply chucking it either, more like a side wrist slinging. You could say she slung or slanged it, the small plastic lighter, with velocity, or maybe I could simply say she threw it, as in definitely at me, directly as earlier she had thrown her Pillbox hat in my general direction, though my poetry girlfriend caught the hat in her lap. About the lighter, Pillbox cackled, actually more like a smothered chortle. She said, made by Tao. That's it. Made by Tao, she linking the Bic to the poem in the line where she got it about my reference to napalm in the napalm poem produced by Tao Chemical, said the poem. And so it was maybe this or the other, I don't know, which provoked the thing, her narrow laugh and throwing the made by Tao lighter at me to say, made by Tao, made by Tao. I have since come to say, made by Tao, and tell the Pillbox story.
Look for more information about WA at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.